Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
And we all talk about the problems of sick care versus health care, and they're right, because we understand the business model of sick care. I'm sick. Here's a therapeutic. I take the therapeutic. You monetize it. Awesome. The closest thing that we have to the healthcare business model is the gym. And I'm sorry, but if you sign up and don't go, I make more money. It's not a really good business model yet. But we're seeing, I think, a lot more experimentation on how you do different business models, how we think about prevention, how we think about health optimization, or if you do better, I make more money.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome to another episode of the Real Pharma Podcast. Today, we are exploring the fascinating intersection of technology and biology, also known as tech bio, with one of the most insightful voices in the space, Jason Scharf. Jason is a trailblazer in catalyzing innovation with over two decades of experience at the forefront of healthcare and biotechnology. As an early stage investor, Jason specializes in the bioinnovation tech stack and the business of health, with a portfolio that includes transformative companies like Centrillo, Plano, Blue Nalu, and Iridia.
Yeah, and Jason's journey is as diverse as it is impressive. He's held strategic leadership roles at industry giants like Amgen, BD, and Illumina, where he drove everything from global strategy to product launches and business development.
And as if that wasn't enough, Jason's also the host of Austin Next, a podcast that explores how ecosystems foster innovation and entrepreneurship in Austin, Texas, one of the fastest growing tech and biotech hubs in the world. His passion for uncovering what drives the convergence of biology, technology, and innovation is nothing short of inspiring.
So from his unique perspective as an investor, strategist, and thought leader, Jason will help us unpack the opportunities, challenges, and transformative potential of tech bio. Jason, welcome to the Real Pharma Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's
welcome to
fun
the
being
show,
on the
Jason.
Other side of the mic.
Yes, because usually you're the one who peppers other people with questions. So I am super thrilled to have you on the show, Jason, because I don't know anything about tech bio. So can you start at the very beginning and give us a definition of what tech bio actually means?
Well, I think to start with, it is kind of that question of, we hear these terms like life science, biotech, tech bio. And I think it's a frame of which we want to put something into a box of the next thing. And right. And I think you kind of had it in its head, which was, it was the inversion of biotech, which was, rather than being the drug discovery process and using a new type of technology, which when you think about the origin of biotech was genetic engineering, it now was moving forward to these new types of technology first platform understanding as biology becomes more of an engineered science. And it's funny because as you were kind of reading the bio in the introduction, I've started to lean a little bit away from using the tech bio term only because I think it's starting to get a little bit too limiting. And I've started to lean into the term the bioinnovation tech stack. And I think of that because as biology is becoming more of an engineered science, we can start to think of it as we do technology. There are layers to the tech stack where you have all the way from, you know, foundational, the pieces that are building, you know, you think about, you know, foundational models. We now have biological AI models that are being built all the way up to the applications in the case that we're thinking about drugs, devices, diagnostics, things that are actually touching the clinical applications and touching the patients. So when we start thinking about it in that way, it's an entirely new method that we think about how the nature of our industry looks and even the business models that come along with it.
So, you know, what's led to the rise of tech bio? And I still think it's on that kind of upward trajectory, but I'm not sure 10 years ago, certainly, and not 20 years ago, that wasn't a term that anybody would have understood the way that we understand it today. And so what has been the catalyst to kind of bring this forward where this is its own distinct category, where there's additional investment, you know, into this space Is it really just technology is caught up with or now is able to meaningfully contribute in this area where that didn't exist before? Or is there some other factor at play here?
Well, it used to be, I think, that, you know, drug discovery so much was driven by just that discovery. So we found this new, you know, lock and key protein that we're going to be able to drug around. We found this new pathway, and then we're going to go essentially brute force it. I mean, I don't know how else we want to put it, but that's what it was, right? We're going to say, okay, we're going to go, you know, the big 90s innovation was high throughput screening. What is that? Here is 10,000, a million molecules, and we're going to see what works, right? So it really was a discovery process. As you think about now with the Human Genome Project being completed in the early 2000s, the rise of things like Illumina and understanding the correlation between the genome and, you know, we saw that in oncology a lot more. Really, what is the correlation between those different types of understanding of human biology and how that relates to medicines, diseases, therapies? You can start applying technological principles to that. So the tool sets, when we used to think about, everyone's like, oh, let's go, you know, you want to be the Levi Strauss, you want to do the picks and shovels. And the way I always think about that is picks and shovels were commodities. You know, Levi Strauss during the gold rush made a lot of money doing that, but there wasn't any differentiation between this picks and shovels. In today's world, I think of the picks and shovels as pipettes, you know, like it's really, that is the commodity side versus when you think about sequencers, you think about gene editing, you think about AI models, all of this is actually where there is value being created. And I think that's been the rise of where you think about tech bios come into is the tools themselves provide actual value and insight versus, okay, I can swap in anybody's pipette in, I can swap in anybody's, you know, PCR machine and outcomes. It's a, just a tool to help me do day-to-day work. And I think that's been the switch.
So those tools, just a way to reframe that maybe, have advanced to the point where they can meaningfully contribute to the process and outperform maybe traditional methods. So, you know, 10 years ago, maybe that wasn't true. And now that is increasingly true just because of better software, better computing power. You know, is that, am I thinking about that the right way?
I think it's a convergence of the tools themselves getting better, our understanding of them getting better. And then you have things like horizontal technologies themselves that, you know, we think of, you know, obviously the AI boom, which has been coming into biology slowly and then now quickly, so that our fundamental of what's possible, right? You know, the whole, you know, in a technology perspective, the ability to read and write in biology is a new concept. You know, we did it at such scale when Genentech and Amgen were first born in the late 70s. Yeah, we could do it, but, you know, it was not really something you could do so well versus if you think about the speed at which CRISPR, like it was discovered in 2012 to got the Nobel Prize in 2020 to the first CRISPR-based medicines came out last year. I mean, the speed at which that's been discovered, deployed into the clinic, and then now we're already on, and I'm people much smarter than I am with this, but like we're on like the third, fourth versions of CRISPR. And then I think it was the ARC Institute and the Evo model, which is now designing from scratch using AI model, new CRISPR-based technologies. Like that's the change that's happened, right?
Yeah.
Is we're able to have these types of technologies coming at us at a pace at which unlike anything we've seen before.
So Jason, just to dig into this a little bit more, it sounds like to me initially TechBio was really just leading with technology to do what we traditionally did in the past in very laborious ways. But if I understand you correctly now, it's transcended that because just the scale and the speed of what we're seeing has led to a true kind of new level of innovation. Is that fair?
I think it's a good way. I think that, yes, I think the tech bio was a lot of bringing technological know-how and, you know, software first and things like that into the, as you said, the way that we used to do things, right? We're going to do computation faster. Instead of having bioinformaticians building from scratch, we'd have off-the-shelf software products. Now it is more heading towards a value migration to the actual different layers of the tech stack that you can say, okay, what is it, that one drug, or is it that one device, or is it the thing that creates the drug or device that is going to be the where the value is?
So that actually sounds incredibly exciting. Why don't we, as kind of regular biopharma members, hear more about this? Is it because there's just not that level of awareness yet, or is it just we're not close to the areas where you're most active?
I think there's a couple of things that go into it. So one, we're seeing a whole range of amazing technologies come out. But I think as you take different models and look at other industries, it wasn't cloud computing that changed everything in software. It was cloud computing and SaaS. And so right now, we are having to marry the business model innovations to go with the technological innovations. And so it's kind of right now square peg round hole. Okay, so I've got this great AI drug platform and I'm going to go sell it to these big pharma companies. Like, well, I don't want to do that. This is going to not help me here. Or if you also think about, you know, going back to kind of like innovator's dilemma, if we are in a world, I'm going to put aside the regulatory aspect for a moment, but I know we want to get to that. But if we are able to produce drugs at a much faster rate due to this type of technology, so instead of, say, 50 drugs, new drugs a year being able to be created, but let's just say 1,000 drugs, take it all the way to the edge, the billion-dollar drug doesn't exist anymore. That model doesn't work. Well, if I'm Pfizer, or if I'm Merck, or if I'm any of the big, like, that's destroying my business model. We're now in a Kodak moment. They're not going to be like, of course I want to take this on. Instead, it's going to be like, oh, this doesn't work. And it probably the model looks different. I mean, and you know, I invest in this space and I'm big, I look something more like Apple, or like you take a small cut, but then the price of drugs move down. And so that's one of the reasons that you may not be hearing about this is the adoption by the large players is they're still trying to figure out what that means. Now, we saw just the other day that I think it was Novartis just either acquired or made a big deal with Schrodinger. So you're seeing some of these type of connections happen and more, but I think we're at the beginning of this wave that I think is about to hit.
But couldn't you also say, conversely, if you're one of those smaller companies that can develop drugs on a completely different scale than before, it also is not maybe in your best interest to partner with just one company, because you could partner with many companies, you could keep all the IP, and you stay independent. So you're basically like a supplier. So you have these molecules, you look at who's interested in, you know, certain therapeutic areas or certain mechanisms of action and so on, and then you can just supply to whoever is most interested.
Well, I think you're hitting the nail on the head is what does the model look like in this going forward? Is it even an asset model? At your point, am I producing all these assets and partnering? Am I producing a platform only and then they're just using it? So this is kind of the moment that we're at, I think, right now, and figuring out what does the business model of AI drug discovery as just one aspect of this look like. And then when you're dealing with this kind of new types of models, how does clinical trials work? How do all of these different phrases? I mean, I talk a lot with people kind of in the, you know, the rare disease space. And one of the things that frustrates me so much about the rare disease space is we spend so much energy on, if we just spend this much more dollars on the science, then we'll crack it. Like, rare disease at its core is a business model problem. It's a business model problem. It's like, if I can't make money on 10,000 people getting this drug, then I'm not going to spend the science on it. But if we solve the business model side of it, the science quickly follows. It's why we have it's why I never like take much credence when everyone talks about, oh, well, GLP-1s, they have all of these side effects. I'm like, there are billions and billions and billions of dollars on the table. You don't think that Eli Lilly and all of them would say, like, go solve the side effects quickly, because if we win, there's a lot at the table.
So, yeah, I think this is a really fascinating subject, and I'm glad we got here. And I'm going to ask Jason, you know, to see you to look into your crystal ball a little bit here. So here's my question. So, you know, the traditional big pharma, are they, because, you know, I like where you said that maybe we're at this Kodak moment, right? I like that analogy. So is big pharma, traditional big pharma, I won't name any names here, but are they nimble and innovative enough to modify, to reinvent their model, to fully capitalize or realize the value of some of these innovations? Or are there other companies that are structured differently, that are maybe small today, that are going to be the next Lilly's or Pfizer's because they're going to outperform the traditional models because of, you know, this new kind of approach to the model itself and the technology that's behind that. You know, you have any predictions there?
Of course, they're not nimble or able to adapt to this. And that
is
not
even a knock.
You want to name
names on that one?
Well, no, that's not even a knock specifically on the specific companies. If you look at the history of, I mean, when you look at Clayton Christensen's work or any of the work in this space, the number of companies that you can list that have made the ability to disrupt themselves is one handful. I mean, IBM's shift from mainframes to PCs is studied because it's like the one time it's ever happened. So the ability to say, oh, well, that, you know, they did this or, you know, can they do this is no. And can, you know, can one prove me wrong? Possibly. But it is the history of large companies and incentive structures. Because if you think about it, I have a $1 billion franchise and I need to then say, no, I'm going to invest in something that makes those franchises obsolete. Doesn't actually make mathematical sense when you're pitching that. So it takes a certain level of fortitude. It takes a certain level of foresight to say, we're going to destroy this franchise and for something that isn't going to make the same types of revenue, the same types of financial profile until way out. And that you can only really do this, not to use an overused term that, you know, we all see like the founder mode, manager mode, you know, with Paul Graham's essay that came out like recently, that founders who own, you know, the legacy of the kind of company and have that kind of mentality, who've been able to make those types of shifts. And almost every one of our large pharma companies, and this is, I think, of almost every large company that are so, you know, 100 years old, 50 years old, whatever, they can't make these kinds of shifts because they don't have the type of stake in it that you'll see a founder have, right?
So, Jason, then what is it going to take to create that ecosystem? And from everything you've said so far, this is kind of a revolution. So you'll need many players probably to create some sort of momentum, right? And it's probably going to take a while. But what kind of skill set do people need to be part of this?
Well, so I think it is, you know, I think we're going to see a rapid transformation in kind of the biohealth arena, unlike anything that we've seen in that arena in a long time. But that's okay. We've seen that in tech. We've seen that in defense tech right now. I mean, if you look at, that's kind of another analogy I look at, is in the kind of what's called like the Last Supper post, you know, the Cold War ending, there was this moment of like, we had the five major primes of Boeing and Raytheon all kind of coming together saying, okay, this is how we survive. And that is, in some ways, you kind of look at what a pharma is today, and it took the kind of radical founders who went through all and saying, okay, creating SpaceX, Palantir, Anduril, saying, well, no, we're going to do something differently. We're going to create this new technology and these new business models. And today, I mean, we all see, I mean, Boeing is a zombie company in many ways, right? It's not moving. The same thing with a lot of these companies. And they are new. I mean, I was actually at Starship 6 launch this, you know, this past couple of days, which was absolutely amazing. It's a completely different.
Saw your post on that. That looked really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And so it's that same thing. I think we're about to see that ecosystem, that same kind of shift, I think, in the bio and health. And I think it comes into understanding, on one hand, the technological change that is coming. Because, I mean, when we were saying, okay, you start with what is tech bio, right? And we talk about this change. But we are also hitting this pivot point where the bio innovation tech stack is so rapidly changing with all the stuff we talk about, whether it be the genomic revolution, whether it be with AI, whether it be with these types of new classes, whether it be with cures. I mean, Intellia, which is a therapeutics, is another, you know, CRISPR-based, this was like 2 or 3 weeks ago, they had a data come out that said, hey, this might be good for a one-shot cure, and their stock tanked. So you had to have, enough innovation also on the business side of health. We have to be thinking about how you catch things. Whenever somebody says like, oh, GLP-1s are destroying our business, I'm like, well, so is obesity. So we have to have innovation on both sides, right? You have to have innovation on the innovation tech stack. You have innovation on the business of health. And we all talk about the problems of sick care versus health care. And they're right, because we understand the business model of sick care. I'm sick. here's a therapeutic. I take the therapeutic, you monetize it. Awesome. The closest thing that we have to the healthcare business model is the gym. And I'm sorry, but like, if you sign up and don't go, I make more money. It's not a really good business model yet. But we're seeing, I think, a lot more experimentation on how you do different business models on it, how we think about prevention, how we think about, you know, if you health optimization or if you do better, I make more money. I don't think we've solved it yet, but I'm excited about things like General Catalyst buying a hospital. I'm excited about things like Harbor Health and Humanaut and John Mackey's Love Life or Pediatria's new company. Like, just this experimentation, because they can starting from scratch and saying, I'm going to catch a cure. I'm going to catch, you know, all of these different types of, you know, AI things, because I'm set up to do it in a different way. And so, to your question is, you have to be thinking differently. And so, I think, it's a long-winded way to get to the answer, which is, you had that first wave of tech people kind of come in and say, okay, well, I've got a new widget. I've got software. It's like, okay, that didn't really work, right? Because they're like, the problem. And you had so many of the healthcare people come out and say, well, you didn't have clinical evidence. You don't know how all of these different pieces work. And my response to that is, well, we also have fax machines still in healthcare. So that's clearly not working either. And so you need the combination of the people who have the kind of the tech mindset and the people who are like, I know where the skeletons are buried. I know where the weak points are. I know how we're going to smash through and say, yes, this is good. And this we're doing these things. And my always response to be like, well, we got to be careful because lives are at stake. I'm like, yes, lives are at stake. This is why we got to do this.
I have a follow up question to that. But before we get there, two things that you said really resonated with me. So when you think about, let's say, SpaceX, this company has done things that we didn't really think were possible before, like recycling a booster. That was not even thought of. And then the other thing is
catching a booster.
Catching and recycling. And then, so antibiotics. We all know there's a huge need for new antibiotics, but there's really no money in it. And that's why I think there has been very little innovation.
But you hit it. I use antibiotics all the time. It's such a perfect one. Antibiotics is a business model problem.
Exactly.
So the problem with antibiotics is, if I make the next great, you know, perfect antibiotics, we're all worried about antimicrobial resistance, which rightly so. I'm not like discounting that. So if you're the doctor, I make this and you say, hey, great, I'm going to put it as the 10th line of defense. Well, hold on. If you put it as the 10th line of defense, it means you're never going to use it, which means I'm never going to get paid. Why on earth would I ever make it for you? Okay, so then you said there's no money in it. I remember reading about this kind of before COVID. Louisiana was experimenting with some stuff, and the UK was experimenting with some stuff. It was a subscription model that was more centered around the creation of the antibiotics than the usage. Okay, if you set some sort of outcomes, which is, I'm going to pay you for the creation of new antibiotics based on some metric of, it must be 20% better, 10%, whatever the metric is, and is it better each time? And that's what I get paid on the production of new antibiotics, not on usage, then we're completely aligned, and I will keep making these till the cows come home.
We haven't solved that problem, but that's what your comments reminded me of with regards to, you need the innovation, but you also need the business model.
We need more innovation on the business model side, and that will necessarily align more to the scientific side.
Biopharma, for very good reasons, is highly, highly regulated because we are dealing with people's lives and people's health. But innovation often, you know, pushes us to the kind of the boundaries of what we are used to. One criticism in the past has been that people come from tech, have a very different mindset, fail fast, fail often, move fast and break things. That doesn't really work in drug development normally, nor should it necessarily be applied broadly, I think. And, you know, we all know the case of Theranos as kind of a warning example. But how do you think...
Regulation didn't catch Theranos. Theranos was a fraud and regulation didn't catch it. People caught it because it was a piece of crap.
So you're saying even the current system is not set up?
Well, my point is that we put this like halo that regulation is going to solve these things, and regulation didn't catch Theranos. And by the way, we put through Alzheimer's drugs that are based on fraudulent data. And we also, at the same point, like when we look at the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, okay, it should not be called a regulatory agency. It should be called a no agency, because for 35 years, they didn't approve a single new nuclear plant, right? Based off of what happened after Three Mile Island. Do you know how many people were hurt or died after Three Mile Island? Zero. Nobody was hurt. There were no long-term health effects, but it completely destroyed the entire sector for 35, 40 years. And it's only now, when the demand for energy is so high, I mean, it could be more of a symbol, the fact that they're turning on Three Mile Island to power AI. But so I don't disagree that there aren't problems out there, that there aren't fraudulent things, that there aren't bad actors, there aren't different these things, but that regulation isn't necessarily going to be the thing that saves us in this. You think about all of the self-driving car regulation, and we're like, oh, well, we got to stop, you know, how dare this, you know, you have an autonomous vehicle got into a car accident. Like, how many car accidents are happening every day? So again, I want us to have, and I was in a debate about this, about AI and regulation in healthcare, is what tends to happen with, you know, we think about like the High Tech Act, right? In the EHR usage. What did that do? That actually killed so much of EHR innovation, because it actually became regulatory capture and led to Epic defining many of the requirements that no startup could actually lead to.
So let me rephrase then, Jason. Point well taken. What do you think would be helpful in balancing the innovation that is happening at unprecedented speed and scope and scale with a very traditional, I would say, very conservative industry?
Think
that leads to mutually beneficial outcomes.
Yeah. So I think, so one, we need to move, on one hand, we need to move away from, this is, I think, in general, away from process regulation to outcome regulation. So I was talking to somebody recently. So when I was at BD, I was at, one of the things I was at was the infusion pump division. And we deal a lot with alarm fatigue, right? If you've ever been in a hospital, the amount of beeps and everything, it's ridiculous. And what was amazing to me was, this was like last year or something, I was talking, going back and forth with somebody on Twitter. We're talking about like, why can't anybody fix alarms? And the Joint Commission had like their recent, it was like a year old that I went to. It was, here's all the different lists on dealing with alarms. And it was like 25 items that hospitals had to follow. And the funny part about it was, of the 25 items, zero were fixed alarms. It was like, here's the training, here's the documentation, here's the... So we forgot to actually get to alignment of incentives and to outcome-based things. So it's the same thing we think about back to when we think about like regulation, and we think about how we're going to do it, like FDA approval in this kind of world. And there's a really great podcast with Amy Abernathy and Vijay Pandey from A16Z. It talks about all the ways the FDA is not ready for AI, because the FDA was structured for, have a thing, I'm not going to approve the thing. Oh, you want to change it? Okay, please start over. That's not the way we're going forward at all, right? I mean, the entire point of any AI or any software-based thing is I want to iterate constantly as we learn. And if the idea is like, we're going to iterate and then I got to wait 7 years of new trials or 5 years of new trials to get this out, like, back to my point, lives are at stake here. And how many people are going to die because we haven't done these type of things? So the ability to sandbox, the ability to get things out there, maybe it's the ability to get things out there and pull them back faster, but just the ability to be more iterative. Maybe it's, we should be testing more for safety than efficacy. I don't know. I'm not a regulatory expert. I'm not in this, but the system we have isn't designed for this. And you think about the origin of the FDA, which is thalidomide, right? We had this, you know, it was the pregnant women taking thalidomide. And which is always interesting, because when I first got into, you know, this world, and one of my first roles was actually when thalidomide was coming back as a cancer drug. So you almost don't know in these things. And so the ability to change, the ability to be more open to it, you know, my investment partner said something once that's really kind of made me think about this, is that when science becomes policy is when problems start to happen, because things get locked in.
Yeah, I think we've probably all seen that to varying degrees. And I love, you know, kind of this challenging discussion around business models. And Nari, I think what I'm hearing from Jason is that we should probably, you know, given all the innovation and the direction things are going, we should update our resumes or maybe start thinking about changes in our career path. So point taken, Jason.
All of us.
And also like to note that Jason has gone on record saying that the traditional large pharma are not going to be able to innovate forward on this. So we'll leave Jason's email in the show notes so you can send him hate mail on that one. But we'll see how good his crystal ball is on that. But no, I really appreciate
I've
the
said it
perspective,
in their building
Jason.
Before, so, you know.
Okay, let me zoom in a little bit here because I want to take a moment and just, you know, kind of acknowledge that you know, you are a leading voice in this space, and not just in TechBio, but within Austin and kind of the Austin ecosphere. And of course, we met just recently at a Austin biotech meetup, which was a lot of fun, a lot of really interesting folks there, a lot of great conversations. And I was lucky to kind of run into you and start this conversation. And of course, you're, you know, the host of a great podcast I highly recommend called Austin Next. So please check that out. We'll put that in the show notes as well. But maybe you could speak to a little bit about, you know, kind of why Austin is becoming, or is it becoming, kind of a tech bio hub. And of course, you know, we're all familiar, I think, with the migration, perhaps from Silicon Valley to Austin, which is probably part of the answer, I'm guessing. But I don't think most people think of Austin as a biotech hub, right? So, but is it becoming a tech bio hub? And can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's an important thing. So I didn't even think of it when I came here, right? So I moved here at the end of 2020, part of the COVID wave. And like many people, you know, I moved to Austin for Austin, which has become a very powerful thing because it creates a very sector and talent diverse ecosystem so that you have all of these different people who come because they just want to be here. And so what was interesting is, so I assumed like everybody else, you know, okay, so Austin Bio and Health is small, not big, okay, whatever. And then I get here in that first year, I'm like, oh, okay, a couple of unicorns are born. Okay. Then the next year is like $1 billion were raised. Then wait, we're the 10th largest in VC. What's going on here, right? And so part of it is, I think that it's quietly become, the narrative isn't there. So, you know, a lot of people, especially with things like TMC and Houston, everyone always just assumes like, oh yeah, Houston's got all this kind of stuff. And it's got like, when in terms of like the number of clinicians, number of beds, like it's huge. But then the number of the actual, like in the ecosystem, you know, Austin's got like 2x the number of companies and capitals in terms of VC funding is twice as much. And in terms of like actual VCs that are here, it's probably 40 or 50x. So the ecosystem itself is really growing in that space. Now, one of the things, as I've been studying it, there does seem to be an inflection point around the 2017 era. And whether that it's due to more people coming in, different people, different mindset, because that it was very traditional, you know, here's pharma, med device, diagnostic, kind of the things that you would say. And when I looked at that, we were kind of like 24th or 25th in the country using VC funding as it. And then it really takes off. And one of the things that I've kind of discovered or thought about on, you know, from the podcast, is I'm a big proponent, kind of my theory of ecosystems, is there are first principles to ecosystems. And when the first principles and ideas and the company and capital and people, when they line up, that's when you have generational outcomes. And so I'll give you a couple of examples in that. So one was, you know, for reasons I become a little bit obsessed with like 1920s Paris. And I had somebody on the podcast who wrote a book called Centers of Progress, 40 Cities That Changed the World. And I saw Paris was on there and I was like, oh, this is great. We can talk about this. And I realized it's not 1920s Paris, it's 1600s Paris. But if you covered up the names, it still read like 90s Paris. The cafe culture and the intellectual, like the art, it was still there. They were just talking about different stuff in Enlightenment Paris versus 1920s. Or recently that I had on, you know, Craig Cummings, who's from Moonshot Capital on my podcast, was talking about, you know, New Yorkers coming into Austin and being very transactional and it's you know, it's not good and it's not working here. And I was like, oh, hold on a second. Just because they're not connecting into Austin doesn't mean that it doesn't work. Because if you think about that deal-making culture, that transactional nature of everybody in New York, nowhere else than were you able to have an outgrowth of that culture is Wall Street. Like, there's a connective tissue between those things. Like, you can go back to 1600s fur trading in New York and Wall Street in today. Like, that's a first principle of those things. And so when I get into Austin and I think about that, and I look at what the history has been, and this is why I look at it is, you know, I hate Silicon Hills, I hate Silicon Alley, I hate all of those. It really should be what it is, but you can use mental models. I think about Austin as the convergence of modern Silicon Valley. So think about like digital innovation, 1950s Detroit. So it is manufacturing. We actually build things. And 1920s Paris. It is a kind of intellectualism, creativity, artists. And it's that kind of convergence, what it is. And the other way of putting that, it's the convergence of Adam Smith and intelligence. So when it comes to bio and health, there are other, you know, defense tech and other things that like fit that as well. It's bio, health, and tech. So if you want to make the next CAR T, if you want to make the next small molecule, you should be in Boston. You know, and so, but when you think about what we've been talking about, the bio innovation tech stack and the business of health, so those kind of the business model innovations and the tech stack itself, that really works for what Austin's first principles are. And I think since 2017, that's really taken off, because when you look at the different types of companies that are starting to grow here, you know, attract funding, take off, it's really those type of companies, less so than the very traditional, like, okay, I've got my next, you know, drug company.
Do you see that influencing also how investors like yourself think about tech bio versus biotech or traditional pharma?
Well, so yeah, we were having almost like this moment, I'm calling like the triple convergence of capital. So you have the very traditional Texas VCs all starting to get into bio. And to your point, like none of them are touching like straight up biopharma. Like that's not what they don't know that, but they are getting into whether it be digital health, whether it be software oriented, the kind of the more tech oriented type of stuff. You then have major national firms like 8VC or Briar Capital or Bedrock, you know, move here. And a lot of them have pillars associated with biohealth in some frame. And then you have a lot of specialized funds starting to pop up that are going, whether it be, you know, Create or Virtue. And so, yeah, I think that that's starting to happen a lot. And they're all really, again, feeling into that very, you know, that very Austin, what makes Austin tick. I mean, I think 8VC is such a perfect example, because when you look at what they're investing in Austin versus what they're still investing in the Bay, in their kind of their bio and health portfolio, they look really different. They look like what you start expecting an Austin company to look like versus what you start to see a very traditional Silicon Valley bio company to look like.
Where are we on the S-curve in terms of like the maturity of the ecosystem here? You know, are we still in the steep part? Is it leveling out? Are we still at the bottom and just hitting the inflection point? And how should we think about that?
Yeah, so I was having a discussion about this like yesterday. So I think we're just starting a new wave. So I think there was kind of the pre-COVID past 30 years, and there were obviously waves in that, which was very, you know, it was an amazing 30-year overnight success, right? And that kind of grew Austin up to, call it the bottom of the top 10. You had things like Dell and Trilogy, and a lot of amazing things kind of happened from that perspective. And a lot of the migration that was happening was individuals, like individual talent, you know, companies, but not kind of world changers that could bend things that has happened with it. Then during the COVID wave, the big shift that happened was individuals and companies that could actually make a difference in themselves. So Elon moving here, Tesla, Oracle, things of that nature. So like that wave really changed the nature of it. And so during the last 5 years, I think Austin has now solidified itself into kind of, I'll call it like the 1A slot. So in terms of ecosystems, you've got like Silicon Valley, Boston, New York, and LA is kind of your top tier. And then now it's kind of Seattle and Austin is the right outside of the top tier. I think we're at the beginning now of the next wave of that. So you're seeing companies to start to being like, oh, I want to go to be into Austin because I want to go to SpaceX, or I want to go be part of Icon, or I want to be part of Saronic, or I want to be part of these type of things. And so there are individual gravity centers that are starting to come in and pull people in. and starting to have narratives. So like one of the aspects, which is interesting, is over the last 5 years, the number one sector for VC funding is bio and health. And nobody knows that, right? It's not been, the narrative isn't there, which is obviously one of the reasons I try to talk about it a lot. And so when you start having those, the defense tech narrative is really starting to now hit. People realize, oh, we're one of the top two defense tech hubs in the country. So people are saying, like, I should go there for this. So I think that that's, we're now kind of hitting that next exponential on the S curve because people are saying, I want to go there for this.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. To refer back to your crystal ball, Jason, what is this going to be for the next 3-5 years in tech bio?
I think it's a number of things. As I said, I think it's, we're known for, we're going to be the convergence, I said, of atoms, bits, and intelligence. And so those things, that convergence points, plays out in a couple of different ways. I said, it's going to be bio and health. It's going to be defense tech. It's going to be advanced manufacturing. It's going to be robotics. It's those things of where the digital innovation meets the real world and where there is a level of intelligence that goes with it, whether that be AI, what, you know, human augmented intelligence, like we have in our world with doctors or the like. So I think that's those things, that's the highest layer that I think about it. And then you have the different, you know, sectors that kind of fall into that underneath. And I think,
and specifically for health?
Yeah. So for bio and health, I really do think it is those two sides of the coin, which is the bio innovation tech stack. So all the things that are the, you know, the factory is the product, the things that create the drugs, devices, and diagnostics, and then the businesses and the new ways that we're going to be creating the healthcare system. I think those are the two pillars of that Austin is starting to thrive on. It's going to be the new way we do health.
Okay, give me one level below that. Give me some specific examples of what you think could be super exciting. You talked about CRISPR, you talked about AI. What do you see happening soon?
So, I mean, I named some companies that I think are here that I think are exciting. I mean, there's a company here called Emerald Cloud Lab, which is literally remote controlled labs. So like instead of building your own lab, you send them your sample and then you can control the lab from your computer. They have a software stack. They have all these different types of, you know, they have all these different types of equipment. So whatever you need. And then it was funny because when I first met them, I was like, oh, well, this is great for like big companies, but I can't see small companies using this. It's not flexible enough. And they're like, yeah, you can do 5 experiments in a day. So like this ability to be that flexible, and then it changes the entire nature of what you can do. Because before it's like, well, what if I want to run that one experiment? But it's $250,000 to buy the piece of equipment and then the $100 to run it once. Well, now suddenly we can tinker. Now we can, like, we always joke, like, there's no such thing as the pivot in a bio company because, like, how would you pivot? But now you can tinker, now you can pivot, now you can do different types of experiments, right? And then on the other side, you have things like Harbor Health, which is reimagining how you're doing, you know, primary and specialty care and really just the nature of interacting with your doctor. Or there's a company called Thatch, which is back to how we pay for healthcare that. Now, this is, I will say, regulations we were talking about before, but this was one that was interesting. There's a regulation called ICHRA, which is the idea that instead of buying health insurance, your company just gives you money to go on and buy whatever health insurance that you want. Now, the problem with that, of course, is it's a mess. It's hard. And so this company, Thatch, which they raised $38 million, I think, in a Series A recently back from Andreessen and a number of others, is they want to make that system easier. So they're kind of, and be able to actually utilize. And when you then enable market forces from these different types of insurance companies, because think about it, you're not the customer for these insurance companies, the employers are. But if suddenly you become the customer for these insurance companies, they will likely make more personalized products. They'll likely make things that are better. So then you have the ability to use different things. And I was listening to an interview with the founders recently, and they've made this really interesting point that people were ending up with more money at the end of the year. Like, I've got $600 or $700 left at the end of the year. So let me go take a screening test. Let me go take a, you know, use it on X, Y, or Z. And you start to actually introduce market forces in. And so then those are kind of the two ends of the spectrum. It's like, we're changing the way we're doing research. It's changing the way we're doing experimentation. And then we're changing the way we're actually our relationship with medicine.
So, Jason, you're an active early stage investor in this area. So you're placing your bets, and it'd be great to just understand what you look for, like maybe just at a high level, your investment philosophy, and then, you know, what are the things you're looking for as you place those bets?
So I think is listening to this, you can kind of get a sense of the thesis, which is really those two pillars, right? And I think there's a value migration to those two pillars. I think the next thing is when I think about it's founders that are willing to kind of run through the wall and understand that this change is happening and what we have to go through to do it. I think it always, and not to knock anybody that's going to do this, but when we think about, like, I'm not looking for the next 10% medical device. I'm not looking for, like, you know, I don't invest in straight therapeutics because, you know, my investment partner likes to talk a lot about there was this amazing AI device that brought their company a 7% increase in their market cap. It was United Healthcare, and they had an AI auto rejector. Like, I don't want things that are like, that's not good for us, right? That's not good in this thing. But like, how can we fundamentally change the nature of health and really, you know, optimize and prevent and bring things forward? So you have to be willing to bust through the wall. I mean, I think that somebody posted this recently. Everybody's seen, like, Moneyball. And so there's this great scene. It's not Rooney Sims, the Rooster. There's this great scene at the end where, you know, the owner of the Red Sox is talking to, you know, Brad Pitt's character. He's like, you change things, but like the first guy through the wall always gets bloodied. And we're understanding that we're at that moment right now. And if we're going to change the hospital systems, if we're going to change, we said, like, the big pharma, like, you have to be willing to go through this. And when we think about, you know, we're talking about like SpaceX and all these companies, SpaceX been around for 20 years. Like, that's the kind of mentality that you have to have for this. And I always frame for me, like, it's between me and the grave to solve this. And I'm going to catalyze the innovation to change the way that we're doing this. This isn't about, hey, you know, we're going to change this. And I am an investor. Like, look, if you can, you know, Peter Brown said, you can help 1 billion people, you can make $1 billion. Like, I want to invest in companies that are going to change, you know, change the world. And yes, then you make money from doing that and changing the nature of that. So you have to have a certain kind of attitude that is going to do this and understand this and be a little bit radical. I there's a great book from Mike Maples called Pattern Breakers that just came out that I recommend for everybody, that it says you have to, you know, to do generational and groundbreaking things, it takes a slightly different kind of attitude.
Yeah, so I think you touched on two things, at least from what I'm hearing. You know, you have to be, you know, you have to break those patterns. You have to be able to run through that wall and take on the risks and the pain that goes along with that, I suppose. But you also have to have that long-term view of it as well, because at least from my perspective, and Nari may share this, you know, healthcare and biopharma, it's very large, it's very complex, it's very entrenched, it's slow moving, it's tough to turn that ship, or it's tough to reinvent that ship. And you know, the cynical side of me, you know, has been at this a while. We hear, you know, this or that comes up and, you know, maybe, Zuckerberg, you know, I think was claiming he was going to, cure cancer in the next handful of years. And it sounds great. It's aspirational. It's a great goal to have, but you know, that's a lot easier said than done. Right. And so, you know, not to pick on Zuckerberg at all, but, you know, certainly he has a lot of resources and funds and track record to be able to implement change. But we hear about a lot of folks that come out of the gates and have these very grand ideas, and sometimes they're come and go, you know, very quickly. That's probably just the nature of innovation in general, right? You know, you throw a lot of stuff out there and there's only a couple that are gonna break through. I think identifying early on who are gonna be the winners is the tough choice. Like, that's the position you're in as a capital allocator, right? You know, and figuring out how to weed that out. So, you know, what are some of the successes that we can celebrate? And maybe you already named a couple of them, and I know you have some positions in some companies that you obviously believe in, but what are some of the successes we can celebrate that would kind of tell us that we're on the right path and that we can do this?
It's funny. It's we see the technological successes happening. Like, it's funny, we were saying off air on how do you pronounce some of these names, like, of these drugs. I think it's Casevigi, but it's Vertex's, you know, CRISPR sickle cell, right? And we have
it's
a
not selling really well.
We have a, well, yeah, see, You're asking him the thing. So that's the point, right? Is we have, you know, we have a cure for sickle cell. And so, and it frustrates me. This is one of the things I've talked about, because as soon as that was approved, the first thing I heard was like, Medicaid's like, I'm not sure if we're going to pay for this. And I was like, I'm going to strangle you. Like, it's a cure for sickle. Like, we're saying the wrong things. And so what I'm looking for is the business model. That's the celebration, is when we start cracking the business model side to allow for, I don't want to hear about the, this is too expensive. It's not for me to saying like people, if that's the argument, saying like we were solving that side of the equation. And I think the problem has been in so many years of our industry, right, is we just like, look, I got 10% better, and so I could charge 10% more. I got 10%, like in we had some cases of like in the 90s where we didn't even get 10% better. We got 10% more. Like, if you ever want to see steam come out of my ears, talk to me about Prilosec, switch over to Nexium, which I think is the worst excess of our industry ever.
There's a lot of marketers that's a case study in brilliant marketing. So it depends on your perspective on that one. But
I agree.
Sorry, Jason.
Brilliant marketing just awful. In terms of like no additional value whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. Go ahead.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm married to a PhD in chemistry. So I understand the like, hey, it's just the chiral form. So it does nothing different. As I said, like we just said, you can see the steam coming out of my ears. We're experimenting more. But when you see the business model product market fit, they found it. We got it. Like we figured it out on how it kind of runs off. And it's not just the technical innovation. Because we crossed the threshold of the technical innovations now are so great that they're breaking the system.
Well, sometimes you have to break the system, right, to reinvent it.
It's not your point. We're now at the moment that like, okay, we can't sit back, because if we sit back and wait for a regulatory change or wait for this, then as you just, the point you just made, a cure for sickle cell is not selling well. Like, hold on, that means that people are not getting it.
Yeah, definitely room for improvement, for sure.
Brilliant, brilliant conversation and debate. Loved it. Thank you so much, Jason. We could talk for many, many more hours, but we don't have the time right now. So we will leave you with one last question, which is, in your long and illustrious career, has there been a person, a motto, an event that has really shaped the way you think about many of the things that we just discussed?
My moment always is, and it was about understanding yourself. I wanted always to be an entrepreneur. That was kind of, for a long time, I was going to be a startup CEO. And when I was in, my thought process was, okay, I was at BD. Okay, I'll hit VP. Then I'll have the wherewithal and I can go raise venture capital. Had the momentary realization that I will never be a VP there. Went and got an executive coach and just asked the question of, well, why don't you start the company now? And like a good strategy professional, I went and put together a PowerPoint deck and had that great aha moment of my career when I looked at it and said, there's not a product or solution anywhere in here. And generally, I run screaming from product jobs, which is always funny because then I end up running product at another company, but that's a whole other story. Because I ran screaming from wanting to do that, and they said, well, you have to do it anyways. But it's funny to look back at that deck because it clearly was the beginning of an investment thesis. And then that's when I actually dipped my toe into starting to invest, was at that moment. And so it just really is knowing yourself and having those moments of understanding. I had that same moment when I went to school initially for molecular biology and worked in a lab and was like, I don't like this. This is not good for me, right? And of course, we went back to high school and all my teachers were like, oh yeah, we knew you wouldn't do well in a lab. It was like, thank you. Wish you told me that before I started, you know, 2 years into college. So I think it's just finding those moments of self-reflection and understanding, like, what are the things that you enjoy? What are the things that you're good at? And alignment. And this isn't so much not follow your passion, but just like understanding your skill sets and talents and alignment and where they go.
Finding your ikigai. Align all those different things. What are you good at? What do you like doing? What pays the bills too? And what makes change in the world, right? Thank you.
Great discussion. Yeah, thank you so much. Really fun back and forth. And I love just the challenging perspectives on challenging the norms, I think, from both sides of the table here. But want to thank you for your time, Jason. And please check out Jason's podcast, Austin Next. We'll put that in the show notes. And again, really fun discussion. I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future.
Sounds
Thank
great.
You, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So great discussion with Jason, and you know, I really love the spirited back and forth, you know, on a variety of different topics. Jason definitely knows his stuff, and it's fun to kind of have a, you know, a good challenging conversation with somebody who has very, you know, innovative kind of forward-looking ideas about our industry. Some maybe we agree with, some we don't, but that's a lot of fun. And you know, either way, I think the reality that we're all in now and well on our way is that as technology continues to advance at such a rapid pace, and, you know, AI is just such a good example of that, it becomes a bigger and bigger part of what we do. And I think that's really part of kind of what's behind this tech bio versus biotech conversation that we had, you know, whether that's in kind of our marketing and digital omnichannel efforts, which we've talked about recently, whether that's in drug discovery and regulatory and medical affairs. I mean, it kind of goes on and on and on, where tech is impacting not just how we do conduct our business, but really the business model itself.
Well said, Ian. I completely agree with you. It was such a fun conversation. It's always nice to have an actual debate. We don't always have to agree on everything. That's great. But I learned a lot, as I said at the beginning of the episode. The term tech bio wasn't even familiar to me until a short while ago. So there's a lot that I think we can look forward to in this space. And I'm going to definitely check out his podcast as well.
Yeah, really had a lot of fun with Jason. Really appreciate him joining us. And we'll link to him and his podcast in the show notes. But another great discussion, Ari. Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.